Hey everyone, it's Daisha. So my guest in this episode is kind of a big deal. This conversation with Jade Simmons took place back in 2013 when she was merely a very accomplished woman, and now she's the host of iTunes' number one music podcast, Decomposed. It's a show all about the stories that shaped classical music. So basically, we're cashing in on her celebrity by rewriting this episode. Hope you're cool with that, Jade. Speaking of cool, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review Classical Classroom wherever you listen to us. Oh, and by the way, almost forgot, if you would like to be a part of our upcoming 200th episode, you can record a voice memo shout out on your smartphone, and then you can send that to classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Your voice could be featured in episode 200. Okay, love you, bye. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the Classical Classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom.
This is the symphony that Schubert wrote, but never finished. He never finished it, but no one cares because it's a nice one. A nice one.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and today my instructor is Ms. Jade Simmons, who is a concert pianist, author, lecturer, creator of Emerge Already, which helps emerging artists build their careers. She also writes for the Huffington Post. And in her spare time, she flies around the city and making sure the citizens are safe from ne'er-do-wells. Jade, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Well, you know, when I got the call to come down and be on your show, I was asked about kind of what was my first real inspiration where classical music was concerned. And I had to give it some thought. And even though I make my career as a pianist and rarely get a chance to go out and hear a great orchestral performance, I can honestly say the first piece that I heard that I knew I was going to be involved in classical music for the rest of my life was Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, the first movement. So I'd love to talk a little bit about that piece and how it's inspired me. And I don't know, how it's just been a part of my life for a very long time.
Awesome. Well, how old were you when you first heard the piece?
Well, you know, I started playing piano at a pretty late age, at the age of 8 years old. And then I have these wonderful parents who let me do anything and everything when it came to extracurricular activities. Very typical, overscheduled American kid. And one of those activities was I was in a youth symphony and I played viola. And I was probably, 12. And we were playing the Unfinished Symphony in youth symphony. And I was in the viola section, which of course has the most amazing harmonies in that piece. And I was hooked. I mean, I thought I already liked classical music, but it was that piece that I heard and thought, I cannot imagine living without this music.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And to experience that kind of feeling about a piece of music at that age. I mean, I remember liking music, but I mean, the stuff that I liked was, Billy Idol.
Yeah. I have a picture. My mom has a picture of me as a little girl. I was probably 7 or 8, and I had, I'm just going to date myself, but I had a Walkman on. I don't know if you even know what a Walkman is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, with the little cassette player and the headphones. And I'm totally bopping out in the picture. And I asked her, I said, what was I listening to? And she said, you know, Jade, there was no telling. She was like, it could have been hip hop, it could have been, you know, R&B, and it could have been classical. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up hearing lots of different types of music. And that's why I think I remember the Schubert so much, because I didn't really make a distinction between classical music and everything else.
So your parents just kind of exposed you to all different kinds of music. And you just, so you, for you, classical music was just another kind of music.
Yeah, I heard it. I remember it just did something different. It felt different in my body, if that, you know, not to sound so esoteric, but I just remember hearing that and feeling like it was a language that I hadn't yet learned. And now that I was hearing it, it was kind of the main language that I wanted to speak. Now, you know, I went through years where that was pretty much all I was listening to and all I was playing. And now in my career today, it's back to this really broad scope of mixing all of these different genres that I look back now have been such a great influence. Mm-hmm. But when I perform and when I look over my repertoire, so many of the pieces in many ways sound like the Schubert. They're darker. That's what I'm drawn to in classical music, minor keys. I rarely play anything in major. So it's had this kind of haunting influence.
Well, let's hear some of it. I've listened to it a few times. And actually, unlike a lot of the stuff that people who've come on have wanted to talk about, I've actually heard this piece several times.
Yeah.
So I'm gathering that it's a pretty, you know, maybe
it's one
like
of the
a
standards.
Top 10.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You'll find that on all the best of classical, recordings, I'm sure.
Okay, cool. Well, let's hear some.
One of my favorite genres of movies, it's horror movies and mysteries and thrillers. And when I look at the things that appeal to me in the classical pieces that I choose to play, it always has a great bass line. Mm-hmm. But you heard that opening bass. That was just this foreboding.
Yeah. That was awesome.
God, it's amazing. And then those wonderful kind of repeated figures in the harmony section. And then the soaring melody comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And he keeps it fairly dark, even in the section here where, there's some hope and some happiness, some sunshine kind of peeking through the clouds. And this first movement is finished, which is wonderful. I mean, he finished this whole movement. And this is when I think of the Schubert Unfinished, I really only think about this first movement.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if we played the whole symphony, as a youth group. It could have been, we were youngsters. It could have been that we only played this movement. And that's all that I really remember. But here you hear this part that reminds me of Alfred Hitchcock. You know what I mean? It's just really suspenseful music that paints a picture.
Uh-huh.
And I think as an artist, one of your goals is to do that for your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the ironic thing for me is that I'm not a big fan of Schubert in general.
Really?
I don't play any of his piano music.
Yeah.
I may one day get around to playing that. He has these popular piano pieces called impromptus. I may get around to playing those, but that's why this, again, it's such an ironic thing that this was the piece that drew me in. And none of his other music really speaks to me, especially not like this. But when I look at the composers I choose to play, when I think about the Beethoven that I choose, it's the Pathetique or the Appassionata, and they all have these foreboding openings.
Yeah.
All the Rachmaninoff I play has this kind of interplay between melancholy and, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit of sunshine peeking through, but back to, yeah. you know, the dark side, so to speak.
Yeah.
I love it because he doesn't spend too much time. He goes back mm-hmm. to this darker side. And people always think of classical music as, you know, kind of this, I say people who don't listen to it a lot, if they have to assume something, they always imagine kind of what you hear on the cartoons, you know?
Right.
But this has all of the pathos and the drama that keeps me playing this music. And I haven't listened to this on purpose for a very long time, especially once I knew I was going to come in to do mm-hmm. this. And so to hear it again, I don't tear up very often over anything. And just to hear those opening strains kind of, you know, makes me well yeah. up a little bit, because I think about how young I was when I first heard this.
Mm-hmm.
And how profoundly it moved me to hear it.
Yeah, I could tell you were sort yeah. of in your own little world over
<It's>
there.
Amazing. It's just amazing music.
Something that's been surprising to me learning about classical music is that people, me included, tend to think of classical music as, you know, sort of peaceful,
mm-hmm.
Meditative,
mm-hmm.
and you know, what has really shocked me is that this piece is like this,
range,
where
yeah.
you're just exactly, you're yeah. listening to it going, I don't really understand what I'm feeling,
yeah,
but I know that it's not peaceful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know that it's, you know, it's more in the realm of excitement and,
there's
you know,
an agitation
sort of,
to
yeah,
you, right?
Yeah.
And I think this, as a little girl, just discovering the piano, and, you know, you start out in these god-awful piano books that, you know, have these awful, politically incorrect names, you know, like Indian War Dance
oh,
or
no.
something, or, you know, Oriental Pagoda, you know, and they all sound like some kind of ethnic mishmash, and you're playing these pieces, but you're hearing all of this great classical music, and that's all you want to get to, but
yeah.
you're stuck in kind of this purgatory for a while of mm. all of this, you know, these awful John Thompson books and things that you start out as mm-hmm. a beginner. So when you... Because I started late, I was already hearing this great music,
yeah.
but kind of being relegated to what beginning pianists have to mm-hmm. play. So when you finally get to put your hands on a piece that feels anything like this, mm-hmm. it's just the most magical moment.
Yeah, I imagine that's got to be pretty exciting.
It's really exciting.
Yeah. What do you, when you play this Schubert piece, when you play the Unfinished Symphony,
mm-hmm.
what is it that... You sort of, what is it that you hold in mind when you play this?
Well,
piece?
The last time I played it, you know, I was a young violist. So I was, again, anywhere between 11, 12, maybe 13 years old. And I can remember just the start of it, you know, mm-hmm. where the basses do this amazing bass line. And to this day, whenever I play piano concerti, the way they have the piano set, when the lid is up, if it's perfect, you can look right out and see into the eyes of the cellist and the bassist. And I just love making that connection.
Yeah.
So I think what you tend to think of in this piece, and what I think of in anything that I'm playing, is I need to make a tangible connection within the first 5 seconds of this piece. And in the case of the Schubert, it was out of my hands because it was up to the basses. But when you came in on viola on those little repeated notes, you didn't want to spoil whatever the mood was that had been set.
Mm-hmm.
So when, as a pianist, we think about not wanting to play a wrong note or having a note stick out, you know, mm-hmm. I think about the descending line of the Appassionata Sonata by Beethoven. It's just great bass line, and you just want it to flow.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to spoil, mm-hmm. you know, you want to bring an audience in. And I think with any piece, that's what you're hoping to do. And you're hoping to do it quickly. So
yeah.
Especially with today's attention spans, you know, you can tell within a few seconds if you're going to want to hear the rest of the performance
True.
That you are now locked into hearing.
Yep. Hope you're enjoying this.
Yeah.
Well, how would you characterize Schubert's other work? Is that you said you're not like a big fan?
Well,
of
you know, because I'm a pianist, of course I know the piano repertoire more, and there are very popular pieces of his, The Wanderer Fantasy, that kind of take you on these really long journeys.
Mm-hmm.
And he's known for writing pieces that are very long, mm-hmm. very repetitive. And I think some pianists like myself might get a bad taste in our mouth because we hear students playing the pieces so often, like in school.
Right.
And as a student, you haven't quite developed, you know, your full musical taste that's always developing.
Yeah.
And so to have to be tasked with playing something that's 40 minutes long and making it interesting and being able to draw an audience in is a very tall order.
Yeah.
I think most of us don't fill that order. And so that's what we're hearing for a lot of it. And I guess more of his music, it does have this pathos, but there was just nothing of his that really struck me like this piece. So for me, I'm drawn more to Beethoven, who has these kind of rough edges in his music. I'm not a big Mozart fan. I think I like to play it more than listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
And Rachmaninoff, another composer that has this kind of these, I see in color when I think of music, so I think of Rachmaninoff as having kind of these deep purples and blues.
That's really
funny.
In
his music. Yeah.
Well, I had Alicia Lawyer from Rocco on the show, and she was, we were talking specifically about the oboe and what playing the oboe is like, and color. That was all she talked about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a condition that I don't profess to have at all called synesthesia.
Synesthesia.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in this case, there's color, sound, synesthesia. And I did a lot of studying about that topic because I once did a program that combined the artwork of Kandinsky with the music of Scriabin.
Right. Yeah.
And they both were synesthetes. But in my case, it was, and I think in a lot of artists' case, we do kind of associate, at least in a light way, music and color, sound and color. So even for me, fashion-wise, like there's certain pieces that when I play with orchestra, I can only see myself, you know, in a red gown. It has to be a red gown or,
that's great,
you know, a blue gown, or I can't play the piece.
You have to color coordinate your outfit
it
to
has
the music.
To. It feels like, I mean, it's just wrong, you know, to play Rhapsody in Blue, of course, in an orange gown. Just be wrong.
Right.
But for me, Rachmaninoff, too, would be, you know, shades of, again, of this indigo color that I always see.
So what about the Schubert piece? What do you see color-wise?
I'm listening now and I hear like a forest green.
Yeah.
And everything in that spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I never see, you know, green to red to orange. It's always this very organic kind of shade. You know, so if I see this forest green, everything that comes from it is a lighter shade, up to a mint or, you know, maybe even a turquoise. But
yeah.
There's just a darkness there that's also beautiful, you know. I think for me, this piece just captured everything that makes you human, and that back and forth that we all have.
Once upon a time, there was a podcast. That podcast was doing pretty okay. Sure. It was eating ramen out of a styrofoam cup for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and its TV was actually just a cardboard box with a TV screen and some knobs drawn on the front and marker. But the podcast had love, the love of its fans. And then one day, the podcast realized that it was super tired of ramen and cardboard TV, and it moved back in with its parents, which is actually a really common thing these days, so it's not ashamed or anything. But this, listeners, could be the story of Classical Classroom. You can prevent this from happening by going to our website at classicalclassroomshow.com and clicking on the tip jar to make a one-time or recurring gift of whatever amount you like. Our parents appreciate it. While you're on our website, check it out. Pretty cool, right? Our friends at New Y made it, and they can make one for you too. They can also help you promote your business. To find out more, go to classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. And now back to my chat with Jade Simmons. So I looked into why this piece was unfinished. Like, why did he never finish it?
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, musicologists don't really agree on why that was. There's nothing conclusive out there as far as scholarship on why Schubert didn't finish the piece and why he managed to get through two movements and a scherzo, and that was it.
Yeah.
And so it's going to remain, I suppose, one of the great mysteries of the classical music world. Dun, dun, dun. Maybe Schubert was just, you know, maybe he wasn't a completer.
He didn't get back to it.
He got distracted by another project, and he was like, you know. But it seems like it was a little more complex.
You know, artists by nature are ambitious, you know, and we want to, I know at least in my own life, everything that I do, I want it to be something no one else has done.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to keep being original, or you think you're being unique and then you find out somebody already did something very sure. similar to that. And sometimes you bite off more than you can chew. Sometimes if Schubert was anything like me, he probably had multiple projects going on mm-hmm. at once. And I think the fear that we all live with, and artists maybe especially, is that you are going to die and not finish something really great. And I think what, I keep using this word ironic because it's suitable. I think what's interesting with this piece is that even though he didn't finish it, he already made something really great just in the first two movements, which gives me a little bit of relief. You know, you're always thinking your best is coming, mm-hmm. Which I do believe, you know, if we're still alive, it's because we still have something else really great to do. But if we don't get to whatever we think that is, there's a good chance we've already done something pretty worthwhile.
That is, I know? Love that.
So I can sleep a little bit easier tonight. You know, if I don't wake up tomorrow, I can probably, people can look back and see something worth mentioning.
Yeah.
And so to think that something this beautiful, is even considered unfinished mm-hmm. is interesting.
What I think tends to motivate a lot of artists that I know is this feeling that they're trying to say it, whatever yeah. it is, you know, and they keep going and they keep creating
yeah.
because they kind of said it, but not quite. Not quite. They didn't quite say it in the right way.
It changes. I mean, the problem is that it changes. And I think as an artist, we need to start from scratch about every 2 to 3 years. And when I look over my life the last 5, 6 years or so, that's what I've been doing. And each time I've started from what feels like scratch, basically what I'm doing is taking a little bit of what's been working,
mm-hmm.
moving forward with that, but being very honest about where it is I want to go.
Yeah.
Not lying to myself or saying, this is what a concert pianist should look like, this is what she should do,
mm-hmm.
but this is what I really see myself doing.
Right.
And it's okay if I didn't feel that way last year.
Right.
It's really okay.
That's great. I wonder if, you know, I mean, this is pure speculation mm-hmm. because Schubert lived, I don't know, a zillion years ago. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if he was maybe experiencing something like that as a composer at this time
Gosh.
In his life when he started working on this unfinished symphony. Like he made this really ambitious leap into starting something new, something different, because clearly it's... you know, it's quite different from the rest of his work.
Training. He's beginning kind of the Romantic era,
yeah.
you know, which I think is what makes him so great and maybe why his piano music doesn't appeal, because
so
his piano
expensive.
Music is still kind of in the classical range.
It
starts
it.
To cross
okay.
over more into the Romantic range. Right. I think the speculation makes sense because I think any composer we're still talking about today, it's only because they were doing something new and great.
Yeah.
I mean, because how many more composers were there? You know, that we'll never really hear about, or they were kind of one-hit wonders. But
yeah.
these men and women who their legacies still last, they were all doing something that no one had really done, mm-hmm. you know, until then. I mean, you think about Beethoven and how he started to play with these amazing harmonies. And then you had Mozart, who was doing stuff improvisation-wise that no one had done mm-hmm. before him. Liszt, who revolutionized piano technique.
Mm-hmm.
We love and hate him for that because the music got remarkably harder after he started messing around with the instrument. But the only reason we're talking about them is because they did something mm-hmm. really great and different. And I think the saddest part is I don't know if they felt that way.
Yeah.
You know? But they did. They really changed the game.
Clearly,
yeah.
they did. I mean, like you said, it's hundreds of years later, mm-hmm. and we're still sitting here having this completely contemporary discussion
yeah.
about their creative process.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's kind of mind-blowing.
Well, and I think when you talk about, you know, in the pop world, you know, your Billy Idols and your Elton Johns and your Madonnas and your Lady mm-hmm. Gagas, I mean, mm-hmm. they're all doing something, or and I think in Lady Gaga's case, kind of recycling a bit of what's worked
right.
in the past and adding her own, you know, kind of flair and panache to it, which makes it new.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll probably be talking about them, you know, I don't know, about in 100 years.
Okay, but, okay.
You
so,
know?
So here's a question. Here's a question. All right. So I love me some Lady Gaga.
Okay.
But I'm wondering, like, okay, so Lady Gaga, mm-hmm. she's clearly a pop artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are other people who are making sort of contemporary rock music and mm-hmm. hip-hop and things like that who are doing things that are a little more complex,
yeah.
maybe a little deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, we zoom 150 years into the future.
Yeah.
Do you really think we'll be talking about some of the creators today in the yeah. same way that we're talking about Schubert?
Well, I mean, I think you can see an example in three very specific cases. The Beatles, of course.
Sure.
Jimi Hendrix. Uh-huh. And Bob Marley.
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean, you think about how different they were for their era and how when they hit, it was just so huge. Like, who the heck are these people?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lady Gaga will be a more complex discussion because it will be, will it be a discussion of music or will it be a discussion of commercial genius and mm-hmm. branding and marketing?
Sort which, of performance art?
Performance art, but I mean, I think her legacy, her legend, and I mean this with no offense because I think she really is a musical genius in many ways, but I think the genius that will be worth discussing even more
mm-hmm.
is how she completely saw what the music industry was missing
mm-hmm.
and reinvented herself to fit a void in the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a very ballsy way,
yeah.
I mean, just decided to go for it. And I will be honest, when she first came out, I thought, okay, she'll be around for about a month. I mean, that's a really thought. And I was completely wrong. And when I look at all the things she's done behind the scenes and like with Kodak and, you know, with fashion.
Right, the Polaroid thing.
Yeah.
That was so cool.
She's a very, very, very brilliant woman.
Getting back to the Schubert,
mm-hmm.
that in fact, Schubert was a little bit of an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And that he made music on a subscription basis to make money rather, and that he would throw concerts, house concerts, and
yeah,
stuff like that to make money.
A lot of those guys did that, and they did it in a musical standpoint to kind of air out, you know, the new music they were presenting.
Uh-huh.
Beethoven did a lot of this, and Schubert, Schumann as well, Brahms, those guys were also writers and they had newsletters that went out. So I think it's really neat to look back at these composers as arts entrepreneurs
mm-hmm.
as well. They
mm-hmm.
understood that if they wanted their music to be heard, you know, they had to learn how to promote their
music.
They had music.
To do PR.
They had to do PR. I mean, it wasn't as extensive. They, of course, didn't have the access to what we have today. But we have that mindset. We understand I could either practice and compose for 24 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
or I could promote myself for 24 hours a day, or I could find a balance and figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Schubert ultimately kind of failed in that. Mozart as well. They all, you know, died with not a lot of money,
yeah.
Which speaks to the fact that artists need more training in the business area
yeah.
of things. It's still the same today. But I like to hear those stories because it makes me feel a little more normal.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm not weird for thinking that my art should not only be something that I value and think of as sacred, but that it should also be viable.
Mm-hmm.
I should be able to make a career and a living from it
sure.
and not be ashamed to admit that that's something I want from it. It's from a very early age, we're just told to practice
mm-hmm.
and to focus on the art. And then as we get older, we are almost made to devalue our personalities,
mm-hmm.
right? So some of us come to the table with very lively artistic personalities, and we're sometimes told either very openly or, you know, you get in the right setting and you feel it being suppressed that the music is not about you.
Mm-hmm.
This is about the composer.
Yeah.
This is about the art form, so make sure you take all of yourself out of it. And it's really a negative thing because what happens then is the music starts to become plain and bland. We spend all of our time just trying to recreate what we think the music was like.
Yeah.
back in the day. And we forget that when an audience pays their money to come hear you, they could also just go buy a CD.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're sitting down in a hall, in this day and age especially, mm-hmm. you know, put all their extra activities aside, left their homes that have media rooms and surround sound, mm-hmm. and come to hear you, they probably want a little bit of you too.
Yeah.
So I like to kind of challenge artists to find that balance. Where do you fit into this art that you're creating?
Jade, this has been a really interesting discussion. It kind of took a direction.
From Schubert to Lady Gaga.
Yeah. I wasn't really thinking that we were going to get into, you know, Schubert as a sort of failed entrepreneur, but he kind of was.
But, you know, and I think for me, what I'm taking away is this idea of looking like it may be unfinished on paper, but trusting that, you know, we're here for a very specific journey, and that even if we don't get to where we think we're supposed to get, you know, we're really blessed if we've touched somebody with some piece of what we've done. And for Schubert, I can say, you know, hearing that piece was the moment that I knew the rest of my life would involve classical music.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was a life-changing experience.
Well, that's pretty powerful, you know, that a piece of quote-unquote unfinished music literally changed the course of someone's life. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the program. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
You're a busy lady.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. All right, everyone, that's it for this episode, but never fear. You can celebrate our entire catalog by going to classicalclassroomshow.com. You can connect with us on social media there, and you can always send us an email at classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Don't forget, if you're hearing the show in late April 2019, there's still time for you to send in a voice memo shout-out to the show and be part of our 200th episode. Just send it to classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Thanks to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM, where we lay our head, like Metallica says. Thanks to the birthplace of Classical Classroom, Houston Public Media. Thanks to Jade Simmons for being on our show, and huge congrats to her on her new show. Thanks to the official shag carpet supplier of Classical Classroom, Scooby Shag Supplier, where carpet is our case. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.